Judges 19. Now it came about in those days, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in a certain remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judah. But his concubine played the harlot against him, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah, and was there for a period of 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her in order to bring her back, taking with him his servant and a pair of donkeys. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. His father-in-law, the girl's father, detained him, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. Now on the fourth day, they got up early in the morning, and he prepared to go. And the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Sustain yourself with a piece of bread, and afterward you may go." So both of them sat down and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, "Please be willing to spend the night, and let your heart be merry." Then the man arose to go, but his father-in-law urged him, so he spent the night there again. On the fifth day, he rose to go early in the morning, and the girl's father said, "Please sustain yourself and wait until the afternoon." So both of them ate. So the man arose to go along with his concubine and servant. His father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, "Behold now, the day is drawn to a close. Please spend the night. Lo, the day is coming to an end. Spend the night here, that your heart may be merry. Then tomorrow you may arise early for your journey, so that you may go home." But the man was not willing to spend the night, so he arose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus, that is, Jerusalem. There was with him a pair of saddled donkeys. His concubine also was with him. When they were near Jebus, the day was almost gone, and the servant said to his master, "Please come and let us turn aside into the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." However, his master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not of the sons of Israel, but we will go on as far as Gibeah." Then he said to his servant, "Come and let us approach one of these places, and we will spend the night in Gibeah or Ramah." So they passed along and went their way, and the sun set on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. They turned aside there in order to enter and lodge in Gibeah, and when they entered, they sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. Then behold, an old man was coming out from the field from his work at evening. Now the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was staying in Gibeah, but the men of the place were Benjamites. He lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. The old man said, "Where are you going, and where did you come from?" He said to him, "We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim. For I am of there, and I went to Bethlehem in Judah. But I am now going to my house, and no man will take me into his house. Yet there is both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and also bread and wine for me, your maidservant, and the young man who is with your servants. There is no lack of anything." The old man said, "Peace to you. Only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend the night in the open square." So he took him into his house and gave the donkeys fodder, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. While they were celebrating, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, surrounded the house, pounding on the door. And they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came into your house, that we may have relations with him." Then the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not commit this act of folly. Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out, that you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish. But do not commit such an act of folly against this man." But the men would not listen to him, So the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them, and they raped her and abused her all night until morning, and then let her go at the approach of dawn. As the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where his master was until full daylight. When her master rose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, then behold, his concubine was laying at the doorway of the house, and her hands were on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up and let's go." But there was no answer. Then he placed her on the donkey, and the man arose and went to his house. When he entered his house, he took a knife and laid hold of the concubine and cut her in 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. All who saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak up." Judges 20. Then all the sons of Israel from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead, came out, and the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. The chiefs of all the people, even all the tribes of Israel, took their stand in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who draw the sword. Now the sons of Benjamin heard that the sons of Israel had gone up to Mizpah, and the sons of Israel said, "Tell us, how did this wickedness take place?" So the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, "I came with my concubine to spend the night in Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. But the men of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me. Instead, they ravished my concubine so that she died. And I took hold of my concubine and cut her in pieces and sent her throughout the land of Israel's inheritance. For they have committed a lewd and disgraceful act in Israel. Behold, all you sons of Israel, give your advice and counsel here."
Thank you, Jeff, for reading Judges chapter 19 as well as part of chapter 20. Rather a gruesome story. I'm sure it probably got a few of our moral antenna up and saying this is horribly evil. Before we go there, are there any questions regarding these chapter and a quarter? Yes,
there's
Tammy.
There's shades of Sodom and Gomorrah here.
Yeah, there are a lot of Sodom and Gomorrah parallels.
So that's something to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, this is actually one of those passages that people who want to dismiss Sodom and Gomorrah as being any sort of, anything that would be prohibitive of homosexuality or something like that will point to this and point to that and say, well, neither really happened.
Yeah, not likely. And yes, Tammy.
There's one thing that that I don't think is drawn out here in the text, at least, is what about the culpability of the man? Because like in our culture,
the Levite?
The Levite.
Yes, okay.
Like in our culture, if someone came to attack our house and we had men, women, and children, the whole, you know, everyone like in a castle or whatever, you know, like if you think about even the Middle Ages, you think about our ancestors in Europe, they did not send the women out to defend them.
No, that would consider cowardly.
You could into the cave or wherever, you know, the inner, as far inside as you could to hide the women and the little children. And the men went out. But yet here it's like, you know, hiding behind this woman's skirt to defend them. I mean, we hear Muslims do this kind of thing.
That's true.
You know, they hide behind women.
It's not common in Israel to do so either. We just read in the previous chapters, 17 and 18, the tribe of Dan. They came and took the idols and whatnot. They put all the women and children in front because they knew they were going to be attacked from behind.
Mm-hmm.
All the males stayed in the back and they said, well, we're going this route, but just beware. And they protected their women. It was common in every culture to protect the women and children, not the males. In many battles, if a battle was taken, a city was taken, for example. Yeah. Males were killed, women who had known men were killed, children weren't, virgins weren't. Mm-hmm. They were just captured and sold, whatever. Yes, Pat.
Does this have to do with the fact that God would look at the rape of a man as more evil than a woman, or?
No, rape is pretty much universal.
Yeah,
it's a universal disgrace. He was technically Levite, so he had other other things were put upon him as far as rules and requirements than necessarily any ordinary male, but they're splitting hairs at that point. Either way, it's still unacceptable behavior.
Daniel, you brought up something.
No, hold on a second. You're Susan, go ahead.
Oh, well, no. Please.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Tammy.
Levites. Okay.
Yes.
Levites had a higher standard,
yes,
of the kind of woman they could marry.
That's very true.
And so reading in Jewish law, I guess, and you see it in the Torah too, but in Jewish law specifically, that Levites could only marry virgins. They had, mm-hmm, you know, and they could not marry a divorced woman or a convert, right?
Right.
So that begs the question, is that this concubine, we hear about her earlier on, she had... The term they use, play the harlot.
Right.
Now, whether she had committed adultery or whatever.
Whatever it was, it wasn't proper.
But she's not a full wife, is she?
No, but Levites, you know, someone who is of the priestly line, at least in Jewish law, if his wife was raped, he was bound by Jewish law to divorce her. So even though she's the victim of a rape, he was bound by Jewish law to divorce her.
Mm-hmm.
So why was he even going back there to woo her in the first place if she had played the harlot? And then he turns around and does this to her.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's shades of, like, there is some Amos here.
Yes, yes, very much so. It's a very complex story that's happening. And by the way, all this did was just set the stage for the following two chapters, which is actually the culmination, the climax, is in the rest of chapter 20 and 21. So there's a lot of unique things going on here, but there is a very important message that God has put when this story in its full context is read. A lot of details that he's actually trying to get a message out, which we'll get to that. Yes, Susan.
Yeah, I'm quite interested in the fact that he was persuaded to stay so long, mm-hmm, and to eat and put off his journey, and still, mm-hmm, on the day that he left, he still put it off and left. That's why this all happened in the first place, because if they'd gotten to Gibeah earlier,
they would have kept going.
But this has echoes of another story in the prophets, and I can't remember which book it is in right now, but it's a prophet who God says, do not... Do not stay. You have to leave right away. And the guy said, stay. And he said, God even said to him, no matter what happens, don't
stay. Yes, there's a prophet from Judah going north.
As well, in the same way, for lingering and eating, and I think the lion ate him.
Yes.
Yeah.
Lion ate him.
Yeah.
And the lion stood guard, I think, until they finally took the body away.
Yes.
Yes, I don't recall them. Yeah.
This has echoes of Sodom and Gomorrah. There's also echoes
that happen again in the future.
Yeah.
There's a lot of interesting things going on. Yes, so recall that story. Another prophet came to him from the north, said, hey, God told me to come and take you, and it didn't happen. He was just lying.
Yeah.
Yes, Tammy.
Is there any profound reason other than I don't want to stay in the area of foreigners, why he didn't stay in Jerusalem?
Yeah, for with the Jebusites?
Yeah.
There could be. I can't say for sure there's a reason. I do know that there is a reason given, mm-hmm, in some commentaries, but not here in the Bible. So it's kind of a questionable reason, so I don't know if it's a good one or not. We'll get to that when we get to that point in those verses. Any other comments or questions? Yes,
maybe,
Anne.
Maybe the father-in-law had this in mind already, that, if we stick around at the house and get him drunk, further, well, the other guys of the city will come and do their dirty work.
His father-in-law was from a different town, different tribe.
Oh.
Father-in-law is actually from Bethlehem, because that's where it starts out, that she committed a harlotry or whatever she did. Doesn't make any difference. Either way, she left her, you can call him a husband in very loose terms, from way up here near Shiloh area, which is approximately where he lived, all the way down here to Bethlehem in Judah. So she crossed, Benjamin's territory, came down here. So that's where the father-in-law was at, and that's where the Levite was at when he went down to pick up his concubine, which is well in Judah's territory and is independent. There's no influence at all from Benjamin. So whether the father-in-law knew what the Benjaminites were doing or not, unlikely. Whether or not he was purposely detaining him for some other reason, yes, most likely, which we'll hopefully get to there. Again, but why he didn't stop in Jebus or Jerusalem, it has a little bit to do with his Levite status, but that's the only explanation I've ever heard anybody give why he didn't stop there.
Okay, Daniel?
Yes, Pat.
The only ones that refer to that did that are the sons of, is it Belial?
Oh.
I'm
sorry, go ahead.
They were the only ones that it said beset the house as the certain sons of...
Belial. Lawless. Mm-hmm. Hold on a minute. Let's see. Hold on. Let me get to that verse real quick here. I'm getting there. Lawless people banging the doors. Okay. People. This what it reads straight up translation into English. Well, not transliterated, but translated. As they were feeling merry, the old people of the city, lawless people, surrounded the house, banging on the door, and saying to the old man, the owner of the house, send out the man who came to your house so that we may know him. Mm-hmm. So what does your verse read?
It's a certain sons of Belial.
Yeah, they weren't sons.
Okay.
it's literally... Let's see, people of the city, the lawless people.
Well,
that's all it really is. Yeah, so lawlessness, somebody who has... Now, I looked up, it's not Torahlessness, by the way. Those of you who are curious, I looked, I was curious. It's lawless. Ruthless, disgraceful, unacceptable people. All those are interchangeable. Any other questions?
Naughty,
yeah, okay, yes. In a very polite way, you could say they were naughty. All right, so let's just go straight into this, because I have a few comments to make. Now, I was originally going to strict only 19, so I went a little bit into 20 as well, but it probably won't make much difference as far as time's concerned. First of all, when did this occur?
When there was no king in Israel.
When there's no king in Israel. That's a very large span of time, isn't there? That's all the way from at the moment they crossed into Jordan all the way through until, what, Saul? It's a very long period, 300, almost 400 years there. Well, this chapter doesn't tell you when it occurred. The second chapter, chapter 20, does. We didn't read all that far, but chapter 20, verse 26, it tells you one unique information. I want to point to that because it's actually critical to why this story is so important, as to when it took place. It's not at the end of the book of Judges. This story, this event, took place at the very beginning, 300 and something years earlier than when it's actually recorded here in your Bibles. So chapter 20, verse 26. Actually, I guess all the way through verse 28, technically. We'll go through verse 28, too. So, all the children of Israel, all who went up to came to Bethel, they cried and remained there before the Lord. Now, wait a minute. Bethel. When was God ever at Bethel?
When Jacob visited
there. Jacob, that's a long time ago.
That's a little bit too long.
Joshua.
Joshua, God was there, his ark was there for a very short period of time.
Right.
All right? Very short period of time. Just after they left Ebal. Ebal was the, Ebal of Mount Gerizim with the 10 stones. They wrote the law, and the curses over here, the blessing over there are the various tribes that were standing up. So just shortly after they went to Bethel, before it went into Shiloh. So it was a very short period of time during Joshua's lifetime. Actually, technically, it was until he died before it moved to Shiloh. So it's right near the death of Joshua that this is actually taking place.
Can you imagine if Joshua had lived through that?
I think he would have killed him. Okay, so this we're setting the stage. This is actually important as far as why it took place so much earlier. Because it affects one of the judges that occur shortly thereafter, who we've already met. It affected Ehud, the Benjamite judge. This story affects his family. His family were Benjamites, and this is actually his grandparents are living through this process. His grandfather is one of the few Benjamites that survived. He, of course, became the longest judge, the longest reignship in all the history of the judges, of 80-something years. Very important individual, very key individual. This is why we know why it's so much earlier. Okay, this actually sets stages as far as context, where Othniel was coming from, who is the judge that is actually in reign at this time. And as Joshua just passed away, Othniel took over his position. So Othniel is alive. So let's keep going. Verse 27. Children of Israel then inquired of Hashem, Ark of the Covenant of the Lord was there in those days, meaning in Bethel, and Phinehas, son of Eleazar, of son of Aaron, ministered before it in those days. Phinehas, that just double-checked our time period. Who was Phinehas?
The son of Aaron.
the son, yeah, well, close enough, Eleazar, his grandson, Aaron's grandson. When did he live? Well, he's actually alive during Moses' time.
Right.
He was commended for killing the Moabite female and the guy that having sex before the temple.
Uh-huh.
He was commended for that and said, God will bless you all the days of your life. It was a good day to be Phinehas. That was a wonderful day. So, he was alive from Moses through the either 7 to 10 years, we don't know, of the reign of Joshua, all the way through part of Othniel. Now, what else do we know about Phinehas? Now, we already know from previous sections in Judges that when the tribes had finished conquering various territories, remember, two tribes went back home across the other side of Jordan. Three tribes, sorry. Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh, 2.5 tribes. And they erected a big altar that was enormous and beyond use. It was just so large. And all of us tribes said, hey, look, they're worshiping another god, let's go to war. And Phinehas, being the diplomat, went over and said, hey, what are you guys doing? They said, hey, this was nothing of offense. It was just a memorial that you would not forget that we are part of you. So we built this altar just as a memorial. We're not using it. He said, okay, good enough. And they all went home. So he averted a disaster. So he's actually a very talented, I should say, ambassador or politician, whatever you want to call him. This is his legacy.
He's a peacemaker.
Peacemaker. That's a good word. He's a peacemaker. Good sense of term. Yes. Yeah, there are negative senses, but yes. So that's who Phinehas is. Now, he's the guy who's still alive here. Now, Phinehas actually dies before Othniel's 40 years of judge end. So he's actually again, double checks us. We're early on in Othniel's time. Most likely, just a hair before the army came over and took over Israel, because Othniel had to defend against this army. And the army was Aram, I believe. It was a Syrian army. We're talking very early. So most likely this occurred possibly a year, within 1 to 8 years or so, after the death of Joshua. There's another event that's also recorded here, which we did read in chapter 20. It even narrows down the time even smaller. This is important because having an eight-year span is critical to why bad things happen later in chapter 20. The span gets smaller. Where did it say in verse 1 of chapter 20? The children who went out and assembly gathered together as a single man from Dan to Beersheba. Okay, wait a minute here. We just read in chapter 17 and chapter 18 that the city of Dan, way up north, didn't exist yet. Not until Micah and the carved images and the 5 or 10 or whatever families from Dan moved up there. But here it already exists. But they didn't move up there until after Joshua died. Actually, a couple of years after he died. So we had narrowed our 8-year window, tradition pointed, to about a 2-year window slot. Which is 2 years before the big armies from the east come in and take over Israel for 8 years, I think it was. This is key. It's going to explain a whole lot of bad things in chapter 20 of why God does not punish the Benjamites in the way which all of us would like them to be punished for this. It's our human instinct to say, you did something very, very despicable and horribly evil and inexcusable. Something that no one can forgive. There's only one penalty that would forgive this, and that requires your death. That's our normal, natural instinct. That's what the law prescribes. But it doesn't work out that way. A whole lot of Israelites, not Benjamites, die. Which we're going to get to that in the rest of chapter 20. There's a very complex scenario going on here. It has everything to do with Jonathan, the grandson of Moses. We didn't leave him yet, surprisingly enough.
Oh, okay.
Yes, Tammy.
Why is this story mentioned so late then? Because if this were mentioned earlier, it would explain a lot.
It would explain a whole lot if it mentioned earlier. I didn't compile the book of Judges. We think of chronological order, and don't get me wrong, the book of Judges and most of the Bible loosely follow chronology.
Very loose.
Very loose. They more follow subject matters. That is how it's broken apart, is it subject matters. Because a subject doesn't make any difference to anybody until it affects an event later on. And if you put a subject really, really fairly early on, early in the story, and it affects something centuries later, you will not see the connection, will you?
Yeah.
However, if you put them back to back, will you see the connection? Yeah. Sometimes.
That's very linear.
Sometimes you see the connection. This one happens to be done along that style. It's designed to connect. So put both those stories back to back. Now, again, it was pulled out of the story, the sequence of judges, as far as, you know, this year, then this judge, and this year, then that judge, and this, all those sequences, because it would have broken up the sequence. And you wouldn't know how many years have passed. Now, there's other ways of doing it. Don't get me wrong. We could rewrite the whole book of Judges, and without losing anything, and re-splice together and match chronology. Doesn't really matter, though. Yes.
So essentially, then, so chapters 19 and 20 belong to possibly the very beginning
of Book of Judges.
Of the Book of Judges.
So does the chapter 17, 18, 19, and 20, and okay, probably most of 21.
Well, that's what I was going to say. 21, then,
not all
really,
of it,
it's going to set the stage right for the move into Samuel.
Yes.
But it's really actually explaining. So there is very probably quite a long time gap between chapters 19 and 20 and 17, possibly,
right,
then, and at least the end of 21.
Yes, yeah, the end, exactly.
It is a literary technique here that to explain the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
So it's here at this point, then, that in chapter 21, that during the festival of Sukkot, the gods go out and dance. So to explain that, he moves the story back.
Yes, because he has to explain where that story, where that event, or where that tradition came from. Because the event had been occurring, the girls who went dancing had been occurring at the point of Samuel's time,
right,
for hundreds of years.
Yes, it's a very ancient.
And so, well, how do you explain this? Well, okay, this is actually what had occurred. This is why it's happening, and you shove them all together, and all the cause, no king of Israel.
Right.
See, if there's a king, a central authority, exactly.
All the time, and everybody
Samuel repeats that.
Right in their
yeah. In case you forgot, Samuel compiled the book of Judges. Just in case you didn't write it, he just compiled it, gathered the stories together. So he broke it up that way to reiterate. It's the lack of a central authority.
Yeah.
It's not that God wasn't a good enough authority. It's that he wasn't physically there. All the time.
People
rejected him. Yes, Richard.
Samuel coming up next.
Yes, it's a big, massive lead-in to the next section.
It's an edit in a way, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's an edit that happened a long time ago.
Now he's going to move forward through Samuel into the period of
King. How they shift. Yeah. Because right after Samson had died, Eli, as the high priest, was sort of the semi-judge at the time. They're actually back to back. Well, these stories didn't occur between the death of Samson and the reign of Eli and Samuel.
Right.
And it occurred a long time earlier.
Well, scholars would suggest that, for example, the book of Deuteronomy and possibly Joshua and Judges.
A lot of them were compiled.
Well, it's 8th century BCE, mm-hmm, that's when the editing took place because there were things in the book of Deuteronomy unless you were doing it for a later period.
We read across that in chapter 18, because it pointed out that when they had taken, the people of Dan had taken Jonathan, the grandson of Moses, and the two idols, carved image, and brought him to Dan, and Jonathan and his line reigned as high priest for the tribe of Dan and the northern tribes all the way until the exile.
Right. Yeah, well, wait a minute.
The exile?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. That's the exile hundreds of years after the book of Judges were even compiled. So, obviously, there are physical... Exactly. So, a lot of things have been... Now, not that the stories were created then. They're gathered together.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of them are oral.
A lot of them are oral traditions. Yeah. So, there are a lot of details. There are sometimes fuzzy details, but they're all there. By the way, this is not Torah. Don't get confused with people doing things right or wrong and trying to compare them to, well, see, they broke the Torah. Well, yes, they did break the Torah, but these are people. People and law are two different things. Yes, Tammy.
Well, you know, like when you read the Hebrew scriptures, like if you read them in the Hebrew, you'll notice not only the vowel points that have been added, but you'll also notice cantation marks.
Yes.
These, even like the book of Judges and this and that, were chanted. They were sung.
They were sung. That's part of the oral tradition that had gone through the process. They remembered bits and parts of that. Okay. So before I waste any more of your guys' time, let's actually jump into this. Now we have a setting as far as a time period of approximately when this took place, which explains a lot of God's wrath that's going to occur later on. Okay. So we don't know necessarily why she left, verse 2 of chapter 19. It's just that, it's technically verse, married a concubine. Note, is a concubine a wife?
No.
Is he still her husband?
Yes.
See, what's the distinction between a concubine and a wife? It's a ketubah. There are rights, there are rules. There are certain guaranteed rights that are given to a wife that are not given to a concubine. Can you marry a concubine? Well, sort of, sure, if you want to. But why would you want to give rights to something that you don't have to? There's no advantage for the male to do so. Well, why would I all of a sudden give this woman extra rights that I will take care of her and all of her children, all of her offspring from this day forth when I don't need to? So they didn't.
It's not required.
So they didn't bother marrying concubines. Not say it's right. We're not discussing right and wrong here. We're discussing what actually takes place.
But there was a provision made for the concubines.
Only during her lifetime. And not to her children. It wasn't brought to her children. She can have as many kids as she wants. Make no difference. It only occurred during her life. Once she dies, her children have no inheritance whatsoever. So the guy can have hundreds of concubines with a whole bunch of children. Look at Solomon. I mean, I don't know how many kids the guy had. But he had a lot of concubines, a lot of wives. A few of them had any real rights. Solomon's direct children who had the royalty rights, those are the ones who got everything. The rest of them got nothing. Taken care of during a lifetime, but that's all it gets you. So, is it then a death penalty if a concubine commits adultery? No, it's not. A concubine is not a wife. Just because she has a husband does not mean that she cannot commit adultery and thus be killed for it.
Because she's not married.
She's not married. Not say it's right. Just saying. That's the law. That's how it works. The adultery is for a husband and wife. It is not written for a concubine and husband.
Right.
It's written for a wife and husband. So if she did commit adultery, she doesn't necessarily get killed for it like a wife would be killed for it.
With more rights comes with more responsibilities.
Exactly. More responsibilities. That sounds fair. So whether she committed adultery, we don't know. It doesn't make any difference. The point is, she left him. Left him back to her father's house down south to Bethlehem. Now there, he's living somewhere near or around Shiloh. We don't know for sure where, because it says the hills of Ephraim or the lowland near the mountain. Well, mountain is traveling along here north, the central to south end of Ephraim's territory. Shiloh is around there too. Which priest category did he belong to then?
Levi.
Which section of Levites? Because there were three different parts. Now this one doesn't say which one, does he? But you can figure out by where he lives. All the Levites have further distances to travel, except the ones that were involved in maintaining the temple and maintain the tabernacle. Guess where every one of the cities that by lot God granted to them? By just casting lots. Well, one family got every Levite town surrounding Shiloh and Jerusalem area. So what was his duties? Most likely, temple duties. This again comes into play.
What in the interior temple?
Not the interior, but exterior stuff. Yeah, you could do. There are a lot of things. Let him go through it. I don't want to deal with it right now. That's his job. He's part of the Torah. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of duties that those particular guys have to deal with. But I'm not going to go through all of them and take forever. I don't have that much time. Okay, so those are the most likely his tasks. One of the reasons why he gives the old man the answer, I'm going to the house of the Lord for my job. That's where he lives, where he's going to. Okay. Verse 3. I'll go through this faster. I'm just getting through these first few notes here. The husband went up. 4 months had passed. Oh, I remiss my concubine. I'm going to go. Okay, take her back. That's fine. I, quote, forgive her. We don't know if he forgave her. It doesn't make any difference. The point is, he wanted her back. Why was her father so pleased to see him?
He didn't really want her.
Would any other male ever want her?
No.
No.
That husband was her caretaker.
Yeah. She'll never be able to marry again, or at all. She's married, period, at this point in time. No one will ever take her as, take care of her, because she's another man's concubine. She's used. Yeah. Nobody's going to want her to take her in as a concubine or as a wife for either way. Mm-hmm. So is he really happy to see the guy? Yeah. You better believe he's happy. I don't have to pay for my daughter's existence until she dies anymore. She goes back to you.
Don't have to worry about it.
See, he's thrilled to have him show up. Can't blame him. What would be some of his potential motives for detaining him? So this is a unique story. The guy comes up, take his concubine. He has the extra donkey, so she didn't have to walk. He had the decency to put her on a donkey. Granted, it's a full, I think they asked it a full, almost 18-hour journey from Bethlehem to the area which he lives. It's actually, we call it, it's about 10 to 15 miles. But the miles are like straight up and straight down. It's a long, long process. Yes, Matthew.
Probably one of the motivations would be to convince his daughter that, one, she should go back with him, and two, that she should stay.
She should stay. That is very important. To ingratiate yourself as the father to this guy and say, hey, you know what, we're good buddies now, right? Yeah, yeah, keep my daughter. I want us to have a good relationship. Technically, as a Levite, he can abandon her at any moment. Mm-hmm. All right? There's nothing technically stopping him from doing so. So as a father-in-law, to ingratiate yourself with him, to try to create a relationship, is a good thing, because then there's more desire to keep that connection.
Because now, because her family was
no, her family was straight Judah. They didn't have anything. They're probably relatively poor, I would guess, because she's a concubine instead of a wife. But that's just my guess. Why would he continue to detain him, though? That explains at least 3 days worth of, you know, marrying, drinking, whatever. Kept an extra day, the fourth day, and part of a fifth day. Yes, Ellie. Okay,
part of that, too, not only to ingratiate himself, but there's a certain degree of guilt. The reason she's not a wife is no dowry.
That's probably very true.
And that was his responsibility to be able to make her a wife. And the fact that he didn't
have anything to give.
He's obligated to try to make whatever she can come up with on her own, which is concubinage was the best she could do, help her make that work.
That's a fair explanation. Mm-hmm. Any other comments? Now, we had discussed whether or not this guy actually knew what would have happened or be happening in Benjamin, right? He probably didn't know much about that issue at all. What would another option, now take it out of historical context and put it into human perspective. As a father, as a daughter, who obviously has shown inclination to do things she shouldn't be doing and come home, the further away she is, the more difficult that becomes. He actually has a motive to keep the Levite here in Bethlehem. Because where is Levite headed to? His destination is the house of the Lord.
Right.
What do you do at the house of the Lord when your wife has cheated on you?
Kill him. Yeah, you take her in for
the grounds,
the jealousy.
Dirt, the jealousy thing, the whole works. Which would likely, because the father is fully aware his father did, or his daughter did so, biblically saying she would die during the process.
Or at least become infertile.
Or infertile.
Have sons to
yeah, her. Exactly. So something bad would happen to her.
And that was for wives.
That is for wives, but as a concubine, he's allowed to apply that. To someone who, because of jealousy, because of believing of someone who's cheated on him. He's allowed to imply, now, strictly because I personally believe, because he's a Levite, he has access to it. I mean, if any old Joe Schmuck from Simeon suspected his wife or suspected his concubine, do you think the Levites up in Shiloh are going to say, hold everything, let's find out? Not likely. If the guy wasn't just some schmuck, well, they might.
He doesn't know the law. He may very well.
That's true. This guy probably wouldn't know the law. The Levite sure would. Mm-hmm. So he's actually headed there. Now, we don't know for sure he's going to go through this process of testing, but it's possible he can. And more than likely, her father knew he could. Didn't want to see anything bad happening to his daughter. So he actually has more incentive to try to detain this individual and convince him, you really like me, right? You really like my family, right? Yet don't go back. Because it prevents him from ever making any tests at all, bringing anything to God. Wow. Not saying that's the reason, but it's a potential reason. Okay, let's move on, because I'm... Holy cow, I've used up all my time practically. Okay, so we're not going to go through all of that, but that's okay. Let's skip a few verses here. So, yeah, he leaves anyway, it's late. Tries to avoid Jerusalem or Jebus. It's not an Israelite town yet. It doesn't become Israelite until David comes and conquers it and then builds everything else that happens in the city of David and everything else we know of. So at this point, it's just Jebusites that live there. Well, as a Levite, is he allowed to associate with Gentiles? He's not supposed to. Not supposed to. So does he want to stay in Jebus? Not if he's heading straight to the temple. Not a good plan. He's better off because of holiness requirements, and who knows what lives in Jebus. Jebusites are not known for cleanliness as far as biblically being clean. It's not in his interest to stay there. So he, believing full well that Gibeah, which is only 2.5 miles further north, which happens to be about 3 hours, because they're going uphill. Actually, in this case, this section there is downhill, but not by much. Let's keep going. So they keep going in spite of what the servant requests, in spite of what would be have been, what may have been better. They went on to what they thought was a safer town. Okay. We have the town they arrive. Unfortunately, it's bad news for them. Let's see here. Do I want to cover that section? Oh, why not? Verse 15. They turned there to spend the night in Gibeah. He entered and sat in the town square, but no one brought them into home to spend the night. It's normal hospitality rules. A stranger shows up. It is considered a good work, meaning good work in God's eyes, to take that stranger into your home. It happens every holy day because all the Jews from all the world show up in Jerusalem. Well, they don't have hotels. There are massive motel systems there. There's tents. There are houses, but guess what? All the houses are packed with every human being you can possibly find. I mean, they're just busting at the seams from all these people who showed up. It happens every year, 3 times a year. So hospitality is very key and critical. No one in the town showed any until an old man showed up. Now, it distinguishes him being an old man, right? Mm-hmm. It says actually like 3-4 times now, I think 3 times. It also says, let's read parts of that. Verse 16, just then an old man came in from his work in the field in the evening. The man was from Mount Ephraim, the same area that this Levite is from. Not that he's Levite, he's just from the same area they lived. Most likely Ephraimite. But he was living in Gibeah, or dwelling there. The local people were Benjamites. When he raised his eyes, saw the traveler in town, the old man asked him, where are you headed and where have you come from? Why would he ask that? First thing, the guy lives in Benjamite town, right? Does he know what this town most likely does to strangers?
Yeah.
Just like Lot would have known. If this guy was a Benjamite, would this town have done anything to him?
No.
No. The guy, old man, asks, where are you from? Where are you going? Oh, if you're Benjamite, you're going to the Benjamite town, I'm going to keep walking. Because you're fine. You're safe. If you're not, get out of town square. Because you're not safe. Bottom line, the old man knew. The old man knew what was going on, what that town does. Why did he still live there? That's speculation. But he knew what the town did. We don't even know why Lot still lived there. He could have left too from Sodom and Gomorrah earlier, but he didn't. For whatever his motives, it doesn't make any difference.
tells them where we're going from Bethlehem up to the house of the Lord, which in this case is Bethel, which is just a hair near Mitzpah. Anyway, I won't go there. I have donkeys, have anything else? You don't have to take care of us, blah, 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 that doesn't make a difference. They need a place to sleep. Verse 22. As they were feeling married with Samaria, the old man brought them in. Behold, people of the city, lawless people or unscrupulous people, surrounded the house, banging the door, saying to the old man, the owner of the house, send up the man who came to your house so that we may know him. Now, this is a distinction between Sodom and Gomorrah and Gibeah. Mm-hmm. It says people of the city. Did it say all the people of the city? Mm-hmm. Sodom and Gomorrah, it was key. They said all the people of the city. That even includes Lot's two son-in-laws were there to rape or destroy those two angels who had shown up. Because the first thing comes to mind when you know the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, where's the brimstone and fire coming down for this evil, evil act? And God wiped out two towns. I don't know how many people there were there. It doesn't make a difference. How come he didn't do it to Gibeah, which we've probably been doing this for quite some time at this point because the old man most likely knew it. It's because it wasn't the whole town that was the problem. There were individuals in the town that were the problem. See, what was the requirement when the angels went off to Sodom and Gomorrah? I think it was 10 people they had to find that were good. They didn't find 10. They found Lot and his family, which is two daughters and his wife. I don't know about his other two daughters who had already married son-in-laws. I don't know anything about them. But he didn't find 10. What if they had found 10? Would have Sodom and Gomorrah have been destroyed the way it was? No. Well, according to God, it would not have been. So, are there more likely more than 10 good people in Gibeah? Mm-hmm. Most likely, because it's not been destroyed yet. Not to say the issue didn't need to be taken care of, but the town wasn't wiped out yet. So it wasn't the whole town, it was individuals of the town. We don't know how many. Most likely they were young, because the old man was old. The old man being old, he would have actually known Joshua. He would probably have fought alongside him, because this is not very far after Joshua's death. He would have known what was right. He probably would have known Moses. Being an old man, he would have recognized him. He knew what was right. The young individuals, would they have known Moses? Maybe. They were young. They might have. Would they have known Joshua? Most likely, but would the influences been strong in their minds? They didn't live through the 40 years of the wilderness. These guys are most likely very young. And as a young group, how easy is it for a young group to influence an older generation? Takes a lot of work to go uphill. He's more likely to have a stronger sense of what is right and wrong. And he doesn't corrupt easily, as opposed to a younger crowd who would corrupt easier and have a weaker sense of right and wrong. Somebody had their hand up. Okay. Yes, Susan.
All I want, don't want to hold you up, but there's something dreadfully wrong with the town anyway, because in the custom of that time and that people, when strangers came into your town, you brought them into your house. The fact that nobody
had
invited, they are all culpable.
Yes, they are.
They knew what was going to take place that night.
Yep.
And even if 50% of them were decent people,
they still weren't doing anything about it.
They didn't do anything about it.
That is common today still.
Okay,
hold on a minute. What? That's common today still. In that we can drive in our cars, drive down the street, whatever, see a crime going on inside. And what do? We slow down and look.
Or keep driving.
That's what we do. We slow down and we look, and then we move on.
Keep on going.
How many of us stop, get out of our vehicles, and go engage whatever crime is going on? Well, actually, as a population, very, very, very few. Not uncommon. Though not necessarily everybody driving is a bad person. They just don't want to get involved. We won't go over legal issues. I didn't want to interrupt you, but I wanted to pick up one point. Yes.
Well, I said these certain men, they're probably like a bunch of gang members. You know, like we have here in our modern time, the cities are completely terrorized. by what those gangs do. Like, they've been captured, those guys down there in the Bay Area.
Yep.
And they had to really go all the way to get them because they're just deadly people.
And I have no doubt. I'm sure there's a lot of fear going on there, too. Intimidation or anything else from the quote, good citizens, end of quote, of the town or region. Not that they were all good.
Right.
Or not that they all did everything the way they should be doing it, but they still weren't necessarily all evil. Okay. That's why, in my opinion, Gibby was not hellfire and brimstone come down to destroy it. That's why it didn't happen that way, because I think there were still decent people living there. Lot was a decent person. He was an example of a decent person in Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay. Oh, let's see here. Let's skip through that section. Verse 25. Men were not willing to listen to this. They're trying to coax them to not attack this individual. The man grabbed his concubine, thrust her outside. Mine says thrust her outside. Some say led her outside. Either way, he turned her over. They knew we were molested all night, all the morning, sent her away as dawn began to break. Of course, she eventually dies, most likely from exposure and everything else that happened to her that night. We don't know how abusive they may have been. It doesn't make any difference. I commented earlier, this is considered, in our society, a very cowardly act. To cast a helpless concubine that is in your care out to something that you knew was going to cause, if not death, at least extreme destruction to her. Though it be cowardly, was it the right choice? You have to ask yourself that. Was it the right choice that he made? Think about this for a second. Place yourself in his shoes. Now, it's not that hard to do, but just think about it for a minute. If he kept her inside and he went out there, would anything have ever happened to the town of Gibeah?
No.
No. They would have, and by the way, it says in verse 20, they would have killed him. Because by law, he is to resist to death. That is his point. He must resist until he dies. So he doesn't say, okay, have your way with me. No, it's, I will fight you until I'm dead, and then my dead body you do whatever with. But that's his mandate. He must do that. So they would have killed him. What would she have done?
Gone back
to her dad. And what would happen in the town of Gibeah? Nothing. They attack the next person. So just because it's a cowardly act doesn't necessarily mean it was the wrong choice. Because since he was one alive, he had the authority and power to do something and the wherewithal to do it. Unlike his concubine, most likely would not have. I know it's an odd way of looking at it, but just keep that in mind. It's not that he did anything right, per se. I mean that, oh, he did something honorable or did something godly. No, we're talking about people making choices. And he made a choice that has allowed the town of Gibeah to receive the punishment that was required of it. Yes, Jeff.
It was a small picture of what was going to be coming on the whole land here. Just
precisely. It was a small picture of what's going to happen on the entire land. Yeah, I'll get there in a minute. Yes, he's exactly right. This is how God's setting the stage for this scenario. I know I'm going a little slower than I hoped, but that's okay. Okay, so this allows us, it sets the stage so this guy can actually fix the problem that's going on in Gibeah, and as well as the entire tribe of Benjamin, which we'll soon see. He cuts her up to 12 bits and parts and whatnot. It doesn't say whether or not he sent like the whole, all the body parts to each tribe, or just each part to a tribe. It doesn't really say. The point is, he sent her out. Benjamin got one as well. Tribe of Levi did not, but Benjamin got one as well. They're a tribe too. And note, the grievance was not with the tribe of Benjamin. It was with the individuals of Gibeah. There's a distinction. As far as this guy knows, the Benjamites living in Ramah are wonderful, godly people. Because every time they go to Gibeah, they're received quite well. And the people of Gibeah like them. Nothing bad happens to them. So Gibeah's a good people. Oh, Ramah must be good people too. So it doesn't, just because Gibeah's bad doesn't necessarily mean all the tribe is bad. But he doesn't know that yet. So sends it to the authorities of Benjamin, which surprisingly enough happened to live in Gibeah. Because that's where the stronghold of Benjamin was the town of Gibeah. But That's questionable. I don't know all about that, but it's still questionable. It was a big town. Maybe there's some way they didn't know. I can imagine them not knowing, but...
They're in East
Gibeon. Eastern part of the city. Yes,
it's
Ellie.
It's important for them to get it.
They had to receive.
A warning, because they knew then this has gone out to all the other tribes.
Every tribe knows. Every tribe knows now. Yes, Tammy.
For example, in Scottish history, they did the same thing to William Wallace for the same reason.
Send him those bits and parts.
After William Wallace was executed by the English, they took his body. The Scottish took his body. I think it was actually the King of England kind of took the body parts and scattered them all off hither into the land of Scotland. But it also became a rally cry for them.
Yeah. And funny how that works. Mm-hmm. Funny how that works.
They used that Bible.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Sorry. Too much noise on the recorder. Of course, everybody gets upset. They all get riled up. Oh, this is a horrible event. This never happened from the time we left Egypt until today, which, of course, really isn't that long. We're talking, 60 years, maybe, lapsed from the time we left Egypt. But still, that's okay. It's a long enough time. It hadn't happened yet. It's supposed to be a holy town or holy people. So they all gather together, verse 1 of chapter 20. They gather a single man from Dedebishib, as I mentioned earlier. This place is a time... event that had occurred after the Micah's graven images and Jonathan from Dan to Beersheba to travel up, all those people that come there, because there was no town named Dan prior to that time which Micah's carved images were taken and Jonathan went up north. So they all come together to Mitzpah, which is right about here, just south of Shiloh, a little bit north of Ramah. It's actually almost a border town. It's right on the edge of Benjamin. Not in Benjamin, on the edge of Benjamin. They don't go in. We're just here in because we're going to go to battle, most likely. This is a very heinous crime. It's a unique response that Benjamin gives, though. Now, my Bible says 400,000 foot-wheeling soldiers. If this is shortly after Joshua's death, there probably aren't that many people. But that doesn't matter. Because we've also discussed the command is 400 groups or clans of men. However many that means, and as far as numbers, doesn't make any difference. The point is, there were a lot of people who showed up. But the children of Benjamin heard the children of Israel had gone to Mitzpah. The children of Israel said, "Tell us how this happened." Benjamin didn't show up. The tribe of Benjamin stayed. They didn't come. Now, all the people from Judah, they have to walk through Benjamin territory to get there. So the Simeonites got to walk through. Dan, probably a third of them, had to walk through the process as well. So a lot of them going through, yeah. It's not that anybody in Benjamin had no idea. They could have easily shown up, and they all heard about it because they, oh, where you guys going? Oh, you're going to Mitzvah, huh? Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah.
And they all stayed.
Yeah,
exactly. Interesting. But it also allows them to take inventory of what their enemy has with them, too. Yeah, at least a portion of it. And Judah is actually a big tribe at this time, so it's a good portion. Not, granted, Ephraim technically is bigger, but not by a lot at this point in time. So, they have a general idea of what they're going up against. Which we'll soon get into the fact that Benjamin has their own little secret weapons that, for some reason, the rest of Israel didn't get. A left hand. Go figure. You know? Okay, so you tell, Levi, of course, tells, it's called again, the husband of the woman. He refers to her, however, as his concubine. So husband can be wife or to a concubine, so difference. Went to Gibeah to spend the night. It happens to Gibeah gets surrounded me, surrounded the spot, the house that was in. Proposed to kill me. They tormented her. She died. Took her body, cut it up. So, verse 7. The Achilles heel of this whole plot is verse 7. Here you all are, O children of Israel, produce a decision, counsel right here. This is the Levite speaking in Mitzpah. Now, would that say Phinehas said that? No, actually it didn't, did it? Did it say this took place in the temple of God? And no, actually, it didn't, did it? Did this even take place in a city of refuge?
No.
No, it didn't.
bad move. You've now skirted the laws that God set in place for heinous crimes. You've gone around the sequence of events that are supposed to be gone through, which is you bring your case, which this is a murder case, you bring your case before either a city of refuge, which in this case, guess what happened, the nearest one is Shechem, and we're just north of Shiloh, but Shiloh's closer, it goes straight to the temple, it's easier. Bring your case to God. God dictates punishment. Man doesn't. This bites them really hard in the beginning of the chapter. They dictated, from this point forward, their sequence of events and what they will do. They didn't ask God, God, what are we supposed to do? They said, we're going to do this, God. How do you want us to execute it? Bad move. You undermine your authority when you go around him to dictate your own rules, to dictate your own punishment upon somebody. We may think it's right. It doesn't make any difference. You don't get to go around the authority to do it. This bites him hard, which we'll get into the next chapter. I don't know if I covered everybody's questions or comments. I hope I did. Did I miss anything? I know it's a very somber topic, and it's difficult to deal with. But don't get me wrong. These are people, and there is no apology from God saying, I'm sorry, this is gruesome. He doesn't say, oh, well, let's sanitize it some so it doesn't do us. This is hard topics. They're designed to be hard. Because moral decisions aren't the easiest ones to make. Sometimes they are, but sometimes they're not. And it's hard to keep yourself under control when you're angry. Yes, Jeff.
Well, maybe that's one of those things he was trying to show, is that how they really have not kept themselves under control, because they've since they have no king, God is not their king anymore.
They don't care.
They're now under their own power and drifting.
That's very true. That's very true.
And we drifted very quickly. Just like with Adam and Eve.
It didn't take long. It was a short period of time. Yeah, we talk about how many years it must have been in Garden of Eden. I doubt they were there for more than 6 months. Yeah. Adam and Eve. Probably a short period of time. One last thing I want to settle on. One note I want to point out. So we saw the wonderfully large response, we talked about at least today, that happened with Phinehas in the time which the eastern tribes in their altar, right? All of Israel was ready to go to war. We saw the huge response now of all of Israel ready to go to war against the tribe. You know, there's one thing missing. Where was the huge response when Jonathan took the priesthood and brought it up to Dan and corrupted the entire northern tribes? Where that was an idol. That is idol worship. That is everything they stand against. Where were the hundreds of thousands?
Moses' grandson.
It's Moses' grandson. We can go against him. He's his grandson. Ah, we'll look over that. And it doesn't work that way. There's a reason why these events are very, very close together. Because it shows the massive response the Israelites have, as long as it's in their best interest and they think it's right. It doesn't show the response that they should have had. The northern tribes, when something really bad occurred. Both have to do with the Levites. It's important to note, because that is the key issue that at least most commentaries, and I personally believe as well, as why bad things happen to Israel, not just Benjamin, over the next couple chapters, because of their lack of response to what was so much more important.
They weren't weeping about the immorality among them.
No, they didn't care. It didn't matter to them. This mattered, the death of a concubine. The perceived concept of someone might be worshiping some really big altar over here. But the actual event of what we call biblical harlotry, abandoning God, worshiping something which is evil, corruption of not just the tribe of Dan, but most of the northern tribes. They didn't care. Nobody did anything. That, I think, is why bad things are going to occur in this story. And there's a reason why it occurred so early on. Even Joshua, the end of his chapter, said, and people did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord. Before the guy was even dead. It's frustrating at times. But that's what humans do. We don't follow the Torah like we should. Even if we wanted to, we probably wouldn't be able to. Because we're weak. We're human beings. We do the best we can, but we're weak. Imagine how much harder it is when you're a whole lot weaker. It's just that much more difficult.
That's true.
Bad things occur.